antibodies. Seems sort of appropriate that on the first day of class we talked about antibodies, but we talked about them as chemical reagents. And today we're going to talk about antibodies in their biological function, at least some of it. We're not going to be able to do anywhere near all the interesting things about immunology, and you can always solve that problem by taking immunology next year. This is an unabashed plug since my husband teaches immunology. So I just should say, though, that although we're ending officially today, there is an optional lecture on Tuesday, and it is really optional. Nothing on it will be on the final, but you might find it interesting, and you may find it helpful in putting things together. It'll be usual times, usual places. Now, to get down to business today about antibodies, it turns out that the immune system has two parts, which are called the innate and the adaptive, or the nonspecific and the specific. And we're talking today about the specific or adaptive immune system. The innate one is very important, but the innate one responds more or less the same way to a very wide range of challenges. And the specific or adaptive immune system responds specifically to different challenges. And in fact, that's one of its major features, and one of the things we're going to have to explain are its major features, which is one, that it's specific, that you have a specific response to a specific thing, and another one is it's adaptive. Now, this list is in your notes, and we'll come back to it and fill it in as we go. But what do we mean by it's specific? That when you are exposed to a particular antigen, you make the corresponding appropriate antibody. And we've talked about that before. But it turns out that your cells make actually two different kinds of proteins, each of which is specific for antigen, but in a somewhat different way. So people refer to the immune system as having two branches, that is the adaptive immune system, that is the humoral branch, and the cell-specific. And this table also, cell-mediated. This table is also in your notes. Now, what we have been talking about is when we talked about antibodies, were the results of the humoral immune system. And the cells involved there are B cells. We'll explain what B and T cells are in a minute. And these cells make antibody, as we've already explained. And they make a different antibody for each antigen or epitope, and how this works we'll get to. But where are these antibodies? In a mature B cell, which is really called a plasma cell, when B cells specialize and mature, they secrete their antibody. They release it into the blood, into sweat, into tears, into the so-called humors. And that's why this is called the humoral system, because the antibody is in blood, tears, etc. Not just in the blood, but in secretions as well. Now, by contrast, in the cell-mediated system, the cells that make a special protein are called T cells. And they make a specific protein that combines with antigen, and that's called a T cell receptor, or a TCR. Now, this protein is never released into the humors. It always remains on the cell surface of the T cell. So if you think about a T cell, it has this protein for binding antigen, but the protein is always attached to the T cell. Well, if you're talking about a B cell, to begin with, it does indeed make antibody on its surface. But as we discussed much earlier, later in development, it can switch to secreting that antibody into the blood, tears, sweat, etc., depending on the fine points. So these proteins are receptors for antigen or epitopes. And so this one is called the T cell receptor because it sits on the T cell, not because it binds T cells, but it is the receptor on T cells for antigen or epitope. So this is the TCR. Now, this is the antibody, and the surface-bound antibody, the surface-bound version, is sometimes called the B cell receptor or the BCR to make it parallel. So if you ask, both of them make these specific proteins, but they're different cell types, and they do different things with that protein. Now, there's another big difference, and that's where the antigen is. This antibody can diffuse around and bind to antigen wherever it finds it. The antigen can be on the surface of a bacterium, it can be the surface of a virus, or it can be floating around. It doesn't matter. So the antigen can really be anywhere. Usually people say it can be free. It can be floating around. But just as the T cell special protein has to stay on the cell, the antigen it recognizes, or to be more correct, epitope, also has to be on the surface of a cell, and it has to be on the surface of a eukaryotic cell. So the antigen has to be on a eukaryotic cell surface. Now, in both of these cases, the point is sort of the same. What have you got this fancy special protein for? You've got it to combine with foreign protein and destroy either that protein or what it's attached to. So you could ask, what are these systems for? The humoral system allows the antigen to attach to the surface of microbes and viruses and to trigger their destruction. So its main function probably is defense, but against what? Against microbes. It also allows you to mop up foreign proteins, but it's probably primarily evolved to be a defense against bacteria and viruses. Now, the T cell business is similar in that when a T cell receptor, when a TCR binds its partner, the partner gets destroyed. But why would you destroy a eukaryotic cell? It only sticks to a eukaryotic cell that has a foreign antigen on it. Now, why would that cell have something peculiar on it? It ignores your ordinary cell. But if the cell has on its surface something that indicates it's a rogue cell, this is going rogue for you, then it destroys that target cell. Now remember we said earlier that cells have on their surface a little bit of whatever they're making. So if they're virus infected, there'll be some virus protein out there. And if they've become cancerous, they'll be making proteins an ordinary cell isn't supposed to make. So any kind of rogue cell, that's what we'll call it, it's a eukaryotic cell gone bad, is destroyed by these T cells. Now, there are actually two kinds of T cells, and the T cells that do this are called cytotoxic T cells. Now, here we are talking about B cells and T cells. Maybe we better take a diversion and explain what are these things. So that's on handout A on the top. It explains what cells are involved in all of this. Now, the blood can be separated into the cells and the liquid part that's left if you take the cells out. And just to be sure everybody understands what this means, this liquid part is usually called the plasma. Now, it contains proteins that can form a clot. Normally, that doesn't happen unless you trigger clot formation. But this, you can allow this blood to clot. In fact, if you don't, this plasma, if you don't do something, it will. The proteins responsible for blood clotting will start their series of reactions, and you will form a clot. You can remove that clot, which consists of a bunch of proteins, and what's left is called serum. So serum is plasma, which is blood without the cells and without the clotting proteins. But we're really interested here in the cell part. The cells in the blood are divided into two kinds, red blood cells or erythrocytes, and white blood cells or leukocytes. And that just refers, red blood cells are red because they have hemoglobin, white blood cells are white because they don't. Now, we've talked about red blood cells before. The immune system is run by the white blood cells. And they come into two main categories, which are phagocytic cells and lymphocytes. Now, phagocytic cells are cells like amoeba, that is, they crawl around and they engulf things. And these cells are very important in sort of the beginning and the end of the immune response. It turns out, in order to respond to an antigen, one of these basically has to take in that antigen and chew it up and present it. These things are needed to process antigen and get it into a shape where it can kick one of the B or T cells into action. So they're needed to get things started. In addition, they are needed once an antibody or TC, once an antibody finds its target, then that target has to be destroyed. And usually it's one of these cells that comes and engulfs the combination of antibody and antigen and does it in. So they're needed at the beginning for processing, and they're needed at the end to clean things up. Now, there are two major kinds you may read about. In the problem book, we talk about macrophages mostly, but there are also things called dendritic cells, which turn out to be very important in the processing business. The macrophages are largely responsible for the cleanup at the end. Now, this B and T cell business we've been talking about, they are lymphocytes. So the lymphocytes are the B and the T cells. And you could say they're the actual effectors of the immune system. They actually make either antibody or TCR. They make specific proteins which are going to go and combine with antigens and either do them in or label them to be done in. And the one thing that we didn't say yet, which is on your handout, is that T cells actually come in two varieties, which are called helper T cells and cytotoxic T cells, or T sub C. Now, these are also sometimes called killer T cells or CTLs. And strictly speaking, one is the naive stage and one is activated, but we use all these terms interchangeably. These are the cells that do in rogue eukaryotic cells. Now, you could say that cytotoxic T cells and B cells are sort of parallel. Each one makes its specific protein that combines with a foreign thing that does it in. But what about this kind, these helper T cells? It turns out that they are required for the activation of either B cells or cytotoxic T cells. To get a B cell or a cytotoxic T cell to do its thing, you need a helper T cell. Now, exactly how, we'll talk a little bit about. But one of the things worth mentioning is what HIV does, human immunodeficiency virus, is it actually infects and destroys helper T cells. And without helper T cells, you can't mount really either branch of the immune system won't work properly. You can't make good B cells, you can't make good cytotoxic T cells, and both branches of the immune system are dependent on helper T cells and go to pot. And that's what's responsible for AIDS or acquired immune deficiency syndrome. Now, let's sort of summarize these features that we started that list over there of what are the features of this adaptive immune system. And these features actually apply to both halves of it. Now, we've already said it's specific. The proteins that are made, the TCRs or the antibodies, are specific for their respective antigen. In addition, the system exhibits what is called diversity, which simply means that there are a lot of different TCRs and a lot of different antibodies. You can make antibody to something that was discovered yesterday, not to mention something that will be discovered next week. How can you make so many different antibodies or TCRs, each specific for its appropriate target? So we have to explain how that happens. Now, there are two other features here, which are called usually memory and tolerance. They're sort of two sides of the same coin. Now, maybe we should say what tolerance is first. You all know that normally you do not make antibodies to your own proteins. Graves' disease is an autoimmune disease that happens when this issue screws up. When you lose tolerance and you start making antibody to your own TSH receptors, that's when you get Graves' disease. But normally, you do not make antibodies to your own cell, your own proteins, and you don't have killer T cells that destroy your own uninfected cells. And that phenomenon is called tolerance. Now, memory, on the other hand, means that your system seems to remember antibodies it has been exposed to before. Now, what we mean by that is, if you're exposed to a given antigen, you produce a certain amount of antibody. And you also have, if it's appropriate, a certain amount of cell-mediated response. What happens if you are exposed to that same antigen again later? The response the second time is not the same. It is larger, bigger, and lasts longer. It's faster, bigger, and better. So why is the second response, or the third response, even better than the first? So when you are exposed the first time, the response is not the same as in second time, and the third one is even bigger than the second one. So the question is, how does the system do this? Why does it respond better the second time? Now this, by the way, is the basis of all vaccines. You are exposed the first time to something which is closely related to the microbe, but not exactly the same. And you make antibody or the appropriate TCR. Then when the real microbe comes along, you have already been exposed and you are already ready to make a secondary or larger and bigger response and wallop the microbe before it can get very far. Now, what is this adaptable part? This is what we've already mentioned, that not only do you make a specific antibody to each particular antigen, but when you're exposed to an antigen, you make the right one. When you're exposed to measles, you make antibody to measles. And when you're exposed to flu, you make antibody to flu. So another way of looking at this is, how do you know how to make the right one? Even though you're capable of making all these different ones, how come you only make the right one? So that's the adaptable part. Now there's a fifth thing we really have to explain. We have to explain these four, and we also have to explain, why do you need T helper cells? How do they fit into this scheme? There is another way of putting this. We know that T helper cells enable these responses. They help eukaryotic cells do their thing. So, toxic T cells kill eukaryotic cells. Now, how do the two kinds of T cells keep it straight? How does a helper T cell know a target when it sees one, and a cytotoxic T cell knows its target? So we want to explain all of these things. Now, the basic idea which explains the first four is called the theory of clonal selection, and that's on the bottom of A. Now, it's called a theory, but it's actually an extremely well-supported idea that explains a great number of different things, and it has a huge amount of data behind it. So this is like the theory of gravity. We call it a theory, but in scientific lingo, theory doesn't mean proposal or idea in this context. It means a very well-established idea which is very well-supported. So what is the theory of clonal selection? So you see in your picture a bunch of B cells. Now, different B cells make different antibodies. We're going to explain theory of clonal selection for B cells. It's very similar with T cells, but we'll come back and consider the difference in a minute. But your picture shows B cells. And the basic idea is that each B cell makes a different antibody. But this antibody remains on the surface. It is what we've called a B cell receptor, or a BCR. So one antibody looks like this, and one antibody looks like this, and one looks like this, one looks like this, and so on. Now, the idea here is, this happens before antigen. Before any antigen comes along, these cells specialize or differentiate, and through development, they each turn on the production of a different antibody. So this is before antigen. But then, as shown in your handout, some antigen comes along. Now you notice they don't say antigen, they say antigenic determinant. That's the same thing as an epitope. That means a piece of the antigen. Remember, you don't respond to whole big fat antigen. You respond individually to pieces, making antibody to each appropriate piece. So this is one piece, an epitope or an antigenic determinant. Now, how do you know which antibody to make? The idea is that the cell with the right antibody acts as a trap. So this epitope, or antigenic determinant, is only going to bind to one of these. It's going to bind, in fact, to this one. And that is going to be the stimulus for this cell to multiply. And that's what's shown in your handout. The cell that binds the available antigen or epitope multiplies, and the others don't. Now, not only do they multiply, and this is called clonal expansion. But they become more specialized. So you notice when you get down to the bottom, the cells are labeled plasma cells because they're bigger, they have a lot more ER, and they're capable of making a lot more antibody per minute than the original. Now, the original cell, where was its antibody? It was on the surface to act as a trap. But now that the right cell has been signaled, what are its descendants going to do? They're going to release or secrete antibody, and so these cells make soluble antibody, not membrane-bound anymore. And we already discussed earlier how you can make this kind of switch by alternate processing of the RNA. Instead of the protein having a hydrophobic tail and locking in the membrane, the protein has a hydrophilic tail and is secreted and released. Now, this process of clonal expansion has to provide for memory. So next time, we're going to get a better response faster. How is that going to happen? Some of these cells, you notice at the bottom, don't look that different than the original. They don't specialize, but there are more of them. These are called memory cells as opposed to effector cells. Now, effector cells are fairly short-lived. They pour out a lot of antibody and then they die. They don't last all that long. Memory cells last a very long time. They can last a lifetime, but usually it's not that long, but it's years. And they are not that specialized, but there are more of them. So the next time the same antigen comes along, there will be more already to, in fact, trap that antigen, turn into B cells, and make more antibody. They may be somewhat more primed, but they're not fully differentiated yet. They're waiting for next time. Now, this is called clonal selection, because how did you know which antibody to make? The right one was selected. Just the one that works, works. Now, this may look very familiar. The name natural selection and clonal selection are very, very similar, and that's not an accident. Natural selection and clonal selection basically work in the same way. And they're both solutions to the same problem, the same biological problem. How do you plan ahead? And the answer is, you can't. So in both cases, what happens is to produce multiple variants, more or less at random. And when times change in natural selection, or when a new antigen comes along in clonal selection, one of the variants will be able to work or cope, and it will multiply and breed and leave many descendants, and the ones that don't work will die off. Now, this may seem very, very inefficient. But if you can't plan and you have no brain, this is the only way to cope with whatever may happen to come. You make a whole bunch of types, and what works, works. So both of these have a similar setup. You make a lot of variants, and the conditions select which one will prosper. Now, we have sort of explained memory, and we've explained this specificity-diversity business, but how do you explain tolerance? Tolerance is explained by a variation. If an epitope or antigen meets its target cell under the right conditions, then you get clonal expansion and an immune response. But if they meet under a different set of circumstances, then what happens is the meeting causes destruction or suppression of the cell. This is called, when it happens early in life, it leads to clonal deletion. So, early in development, if an antibody meets an antigen which is yours, that cell dies. So there's nobody around to make that antibody and kill that antigen of yours. Now, later stages, instead of deleting that cell, you just suppress it and prevent it from working, and that's called clonal suppression. Now, whether you get clonal deletion suppression or you get clonal expansion depends on other factors. Because it's not just a meeting of antigen and antibody that kicks this process in. There are a whole bunch of other factors that have to be right at the same time. And depending on all those other factors, the meeting either leads to suppression, deletion, and tolerance, or it leads to expansion and memory. And this is another one of those things. If you want to know the fine points, you have to delve more deeply into immunology, either read up, take a course, etc. Okay, so we have explained this. The Fitch clonal selection explains basically this four, but not the fifth. Yes?
I just want to be clear. So those cells with the particular antibodies on them get killed early on? Which gets killed early on?
What gets killed early on would be this one.
Right, okay.
So in order to get clonal deletion, when these two got it together, if this was your protein, a piece of your protein, and one of your cells capable of making antibody, this cell would be destroyed. Yes?
What happens if you are exposed to an antigen but you don't have any variation of antibody?
If you are exposed to an antigen to which you are incapable of making antibody, nothing happens. Yeah?
How do you get an autoimmune response?
How do you get an autoimmune response? Well, remember that in some cases, the cells capable of making your autoantibodies are suppressed and not missing. And if that suppression fails, then those cells will blossom and start making antigen. But what is specifically responsible for autoimmune disease in specific cases, I can't tell you. In some cases, it's thought that some autoimmune diseases are caused when you are infected by something that has a surface antigen resembling one of your antigens. And as a result, you make a lot of antibody, and then the antibody, so to speak, or the cells get confused, and they start attacking your stuff. Other questions? Yeah.
Do all these different antibodies on the B cells come from the same, like, mutational genes on the DNA, or?
Okay, so he has hit on the big problem. What is the difference between each of these cells and, say, a liver cell? Is their DNA the same? So let me ask. If you have a liver cell and a brain cell, or say a liver cell and a T cell, is the DNA the same in the first case? Is the DNA the same in the second case? So I want you to talk about that for a minute. Think, will that work? What do you expect? Now, let me ask a question here. Let's take a vote. For liver and brain, is the DNA the same? How many say yes? How many say no? How many are not sure? Chicken? Okay. The real answer is you all agree the DNA is the same. We have hashed this over many, many times. The way development works, the way differentiation works, is all your cells have the same DNA, but what's different is which genes are turned on or expressed and which genes are off. Well, you have just met the exception. Because, in fact, with liver cells, you would expect that the DNA here would be the same. If it were, how would this work? So let's think for a minute. Each of these cells makes a different protein. What's different about those proteins? Well, at one time, people thought maybe those proteins are all the same. But when they meet their antigen, they fold differently. That way, it doesn't take a lot of information to run this. You just make a few different antibodies, and they meet their antigen, and they, you know, sort of fold up right, and you're all set. Is that how it works? Can a protein fold any old way?
No.
What determines how it folds? It's amino acid sequence. Its primary sequence depends how it folds. Now, we do know that adding a small molecule can change it a little bit. We have allosteric feedback. We have other things like that. We know that you can change the folding a little bit by adding a small molecule, but you can't change it drastically. So given what we know about how proteins work, you have to make the assumption that each of these is coded by a different DNA, and each of these has a different amino acid sequence. And that, in fact, is the case. People have isolated a whole bunch of antibodies, and each one has a different amino acid sequence. What's the problem? How do you have enough genes to code for all these umpty-umpt antibodies? Well, this has been bothering people for a long time. How do you have so many genes? Well, the answer is you don't. The answer is you do not inherit a gene for antibody or a gene for T-cell receptors. You inherit a kit. You inherit, this is in the notes, but further on. You inherit a section of DNA that has a bunch of different pieces. And you rearrange that DNA, sort of mix and match them, to put together enough pieces to code for one antibody or one TCR. So the number of pieces needed in your DNA is, I mean, there may be hundreds or thousands of pieces, but they're all sort of short. And then you mix and match them so that each of these cells has a different stretch of DNA coding for antibody. So if we want to, we could put in another stage here. Before you had B cells, you had a precursor that was not specialized or differentiated. And that cell had DNA like every other cell in the body. But when the cell specialized to give rise to B cells, then DNA rearrangement occurred in its descendants. So each of them has rearranged their DNA. B cells and T cells are the only cells in the body that specialize by shuffling their DNA. Every other cell type does it by turning on and off different sections. But B and T cells are different. That during development, they reshuffle their DNA so that each B cell and each T cell is different, not only from your other cells, but from each other. Yeah.
So do these new antibodies, are they made by taking in like part of the antigen and reacting to its actual protein structure? Or is it just going around the shape? Is it going like, okay, is this its actual like protein sequence? Or is it just going, okay, here's like the whole thing I'm gonna put a shape?
So his question is really about this folding business. The way it works is each of these cells has a unique DNA. Each reads it out to make a unique amino acid sequence. That then determines how that protein is folded up. Now, we always draw antibodies as having grabbers. They actually have two. As we'll see, these two are identical. This section varies from antibody to antibody in amino acid sequence and therefore 3D shape. And therefore in properties, hydrophobic, hydrophilic, plus, minus, etc. So when a small molecule comes along, it bounces into these much the way a substrate fits an enzyme. And if there is a fit, then the antigen sticks to the antibody, and that cell is stimulated with the help of others to divide, specialize, etc. So there may be a slight adjustment between this protein and its partner, just as an enzyme may slightly fold differently when it meets its substrate. But basically, the shape of the two is set in advance. Yeah?
It's actually more a question about how it knows how to rearrange its DNA property.
How does it know how to rearrange its DNA property? That takes about an hour to explain. So it's explained in Sadhava, and you should take immunology. Okay.
Clonal deletion and suppression happen during development when the precursor cells are specializing and deciding what to.
When does clonal deletion or suppression, etc., occur? What happens first, apparently, is the DNA is rearranged within certain limits randomly, And then each cell reads out the appropriate section to make its protein. And now these sit around until antigen comes. So if we put our antigen in, this part is pre-antigen, and this part is post. And so the which antibody am I going to make, or which TCR I'm going to make, is decided first. And then the antigen comes along and causes either clonal deletion, suppression, or expansion. Any more questions before I go on? Yeah.
So like this toolkit, is it dependent on like what your parents were exposed to? Is it therefore, or is it all literally?
Does it matter what your parents were exposed to? Basically, no. You start all over again. Because remember, you inherit DNA, which is the basic zygotic germline DNA. It doesn't matter what your parents were exposed to. It's their T cells and their B cells were fooling around with their DNA. But their cells that gave the germ cells did not. The germ cells that gave rise to eggs and sperm have pristine, unfooled around with, unrearranged DNA. And that's what you inherit. So each person starts over again, making a B cell and a T cell collection. Okay. Now, let's see what we're going to talk about next. Oh, we should say something about T cells. So how does the system work for T cells? The answer is it's very similar. Each T cell makes its corresponding TCR. And then, depending on what antigen comes along, the right T cell clone expands or, in fact, is deleted or suppressed. But there is one big difference. We already said that a B cell secretes its antibody, and that antibody can find antigen anywhere. But a T cell keeps its T cell receptor antibody-like protein on the surface, and that has to meet another surface. So that is outlined a little bit how that works on your next page of your handout on B. So we've drawn here a sort of T cell and a B cell. Now in the picture, we actually drew them both so they bound the same shape antigen. But the difference we're trying to emphasize here is that the B cell, the antigen can be loose. Now the antibody can too. Both the antibody and the antigen can be floating around. Now, this antigen could be on the surface of a microbe, but doesn't have to be. But if we're talking T cells, if you have this antigen or epitope floating around, the T cell will not stick to it. The T cell or the T cell receptor will only stick to an antigen or epitope which is on the surface of a eukaryotic cell. And of course, the question we want to ask is how does the T cell know this is a eukaryotic cell? We understand how it knows there's an antigen there because there's something that matches its T cell receptor. But how does it know this is a eukaryotic cell? That requires another piece, which we'll get to in a minute. I just want to be sure I didn't leave anything out here. Okay, so we've said already that there are two kinds of T cells, cytotoxic T cells and helper T cells, and one kind really helps things along, and one kills rogue cells. How do they know the difference? So the picture underneath shows you the difference between cytotoxic and helper cells. The picture we drew so far tells you the difference between a T cell and a B cell. But now, what's the difference between a cytotoxic T and a helper T? Now, both of them have a T cell receptor, and in this case, we're assuming it's the same antigen to keep it simple. But they have an additional protein. And that protein is going to match up to something on the surface of the target cell. It turns out that all cytotoxic T cells have a surface protein which is called CD4. So they are said to be CD4+. Immune cells have a whole collection of surface proteins, and they're named CD1, CD2, CD3, up to about CD50. I think it stands for cell determinant, but I'm not sure. Now, on the other hand, so that protein is what is symbolized by this, except I wrote it wrong. This is 8. Okay? So cytotoxic T cells have CD8 on them, and helper T cells have the protein called CD4, so they're said to be CD4+. And you notice I wrote that like this. Now, the only reason for drawing it this way, so this would be the CD8 protein, and this would be the CD4. Now, you can sort of see from this picture that when the T cell cozies up to its target, the T cell receptor is going to stick to the antigen or epitope on the surface, and the CD4 or 8 is going to stick to some other feature of the cell surface. But what distinguishes these two types is largely CD4 versus CD8, although there are other things. So what does the target cell look like? All ordinary nucleated cells have a protein on their surface called MHC1. MHC comes from major histocompatibility complex, but the point is it's a surface. MHCs are surface proteins found on your cells. And there are two kinds of MHC called, imaginatively, 1 and 2. All nucleated cells have MHC1. Which of your cells doesn't? Red blood cells don't have nuclei. Their precursors do, but they don't. But all your other cells have MHC1. Only cells of the immune system have MHC2. And it's primarily a subclass of them, B cells and the phagocytic cells. T cells generally do not have MHC2. So, if you have an ordinary cell, it has MHC1 on it. But if it was infected by, say, a bacterium, by a virus, or it's a cancer cell, it will be making peculiar proteins. And one of those peculiar proteins will be on the surface. This combination is what allows it to be attacked by a cytotoxic T cell. It has to have the epitope or antigen to match the T cell receptor, and it has to have MHC1 to match CD8. But what about helper T cells? Their target are cells of the immune system which need to be activated or kicked into action. How do you know when you've hit a cell of the immune system? The kind that's processing antigen, it has MHC2 on. Now it has MHC1 also, but we're ignoring that. An immune system cell of this type will have MHC2. So we've drawn that a little bit differently, because MHC2 matches CD4. So this is MHC2. Okay. But you also, of course, have to have the antigen or epitope. Now, how do we sort of think about this? If an ordinary cell has some funny piece of protein it isn't supposed to have, why is that? That's bad news. It's infected, it's a cancer cell, it's gone berserk, something's wrong with it. If a B cell or a phagocytic cell has a strange protein, what does that mean? It means it traps some antigen. Goody. Now we can make antibody. So that's good news. So a T helper cell sticks to that. An immune cell, which has just trapped some antigen, But it's an immune cell because it has MHC2, so we know it's okay. We want it to go and flourish and make antibody or, in fact, T-cell receptors. So that's good news. So this is the epitope or the antigen. Now, it doesn't quite look like this. If you look at the picture on the right of your handout, the picture looks a little bit different. In that we've drawn it the way it really is, which is the MHC and the antigen are not, or epitope, are not separate. The epitope is really nestled inside the MHC. Remember we said that a cell has on its surface little bits of whatever it's making? Those little bits are these epitopes, and they are stuck to MHC1. So the surface of the cell has MHC1 on it, and each MHC1 is holding a little piece of protein. They're not all the same. They're all different. They're chewed up bits of whatever the cell happens to be making. Now, because the epitope is inside the MHC1, really, they're not separate, people refer to it as the hot dog in a bun. You have a protein with a little groove in it and a little piece of peptide, like the hot dog, is sitting in the groove. MHC1 holds a little peptide in its groove. MHC2 holds a different kind of peptide, but a little piece also in its groove. They may be, Sabre versus Hebrew National, but they're both hot dogs in a bun. Okay. Now, one of the questions that we want to ask is, how did the hot dog get to the bun? And this actually is outlined on the last page, but I think we'll wait for a minute. Let me see if that's what I want to talk about next or something else first, because as you can see, this whole business is very complicated. So we will come back to that issue of how the hot dog got in the bun. And we want to now ask, once everything gets it together, how does that lead to action? In order for a B cell to start pouring out antibody, or for a T cell to start killing its target, the cells have to be activated. They have to be kicked into action. Now, in our simple original picture, what does it look like it takes to kick things into action? All it requires is antigen. Well, that's very rarely the case. Usually, it doesn't just require antigen. It's more complicated than like this, where you need multiple interactions. It turns out, in addition to antigen, you need a paracrine signal and a juxtacrine. To get this B cell to do anything, not only do you need an antibody, but you need a secretion from a neighbor. That's a paracrine. And that is usually supplied here by a helper T cell. There are many different paracrines involved in this system, known as cytokines or interleukins. They are referred to in the problem set in the textbooks, but the important point we want is not which is which, but the fact that in order to trigger expansion or deletion, you have to have the appropriate paracrine signal. But that's not all. As implied by this picture, surface proteins have to match up. MHC1 is a or 2 is a protein. CD4 or 8 is a protein. So surface things have to match up and lock. And that's what's meant by a juxtacrine signal. Up until now, when we talked about signaling, usually one cell secreted something and it went somewhere and bound to a receptor. But here we're saying one cell makes a surface something, the other cell makes a surface something, and they come together. So which is the ligand and which is the receptor? Sometimes it's obvious, and sometimes it's not at all. Sometimes it's a mutual signaling in both directions, and it's not clear who ought to be called the ligand and who ought to be called the receptor. And this is a typical juxtacrine interaction, both of these are, where one surface substance combines with another. And the epitope is almost always a piece of peptide, although not absolutely always. So how do you activate a B cell? Now it's time, I think, to look at the last page of your handout. And you notice that on the bottom, you have three cases where two cells are locked together by juxtacrine signaling. Now, there are paracrines involved here also, but we are ignoring them. And the arrows represent either activation or killing. Now, what is going on here? You notice the basic setup, if you sort of look in the middle, is you have a T cell. Now, what does a T cell have? It has either CD4 or 8, which is symbolized this way, and it has a TCR. What does its partner have, or target? It turns out that there are various possibilities for what its partner has. But what its partner has to have is, it has to have the right epitope. But remember, it has to be in the bun. So there has to be over here MHC of the appropriate type. And here's the epitope or the antigen. Now, the three cases on the bottom involve three different variants on this basic scheme. If the one on the left is a cytotoxic T cell, what is the thing on the right? It's a rogue eukaryotic cell. So this is a eukaryotic cell which is making something it shouldn't, and a piece of that was on its surface. And so the T cell came up and stuck to it. So what will happen? This would be a cytotoxic T cell and a rogue cell. What would happen to the rogue cell? Zappo. Okay? The process is complicated, but basically the cell would be killed. Now what if, how does the helper T cell, how does a T cell get activated in the first place? We're going to explain this for helpers. It's a little more complicated for cytotoxic T cell. What if instead of this being cytotoxic, this is a helper cell? Well, how does a helper cell get juiced up in the first place? Helper cells don't just go around looking for antigen. The antigen has to be on the surface of somebody. And in this case, this cell is not a rogue eukaryotic cell, but an immune cell that captured some antigen. And it has displaying that little bit of antigen, and that is going to be the trigger to the helper to get activated and get into shape. So in this case, although it's formally equivalent, cell MHC epitope, it's the other kind of MHC, and it's the kind of epitope you want to respond to, not kill the cell that did it. This kind of cell is called an antigen-presenting cell. And in your middle picture, it's a macrophage or a dendritic cell. It's one of those phagocytic cells. It has, in fact, trapped some antigen, cut it up, and displayed the pieces on its surface. Now, maybe we ought to make this clearer. I'm a phagocytic cell. I go crawling around. I engulf or phagocytize some antigen, and I cut it up. And I put it on my surface. How many pieces are on my surface? One? Many? There are going to be a lot of different ones. So there's going to be that piece, and there's going to be this piece, and there's going to be this piece, and so on. Now, that's important because In order to get the T helper cell revved up, there has to be a T helper cell to match one of these. But I have many different pieces on the outside, and as long as there is a T helper to match one of them, we will be okay. Doesn't have to be one. Now, this process we're interested in primarily because it activates the T cell. It also activates the macrophage, but that's not as important in our argument. So if the T helper cell is revved up, what can it do? It can actually help a cytotoxic T cell. How it does that is complicated, but it can also help a B cell. And that's what the third picture is. The third picture is, what if a T helper meets a B cell? Now, a B cell is a kind of antigen-presenting cell, but it's sort of special. You could look at it this way. What's the point of all this? You, unfortunately, are injected with an antigen. Or maybe fortunate, maybe you're gonna, it's a vaccine. You are exposed to an antigen. Okay, you wanna make a bucket of antibody. That means your B cells have to get going. So how are your B cells gonna get going? Well, they've combined with antigen, but they don't just, as it turns out, go around looking for a piece of antigen. What happens is, the antigen has to be chewed up usually by a phagocytic cell, and that activates a T helper cell, and then the T helper cell comes along and presents the antigen and helps up the B cell, and finally that kicks in the B cell. So the phagocytic cell juices up the helper cell juices up the B cell. Now sometimes the helper and the B cell juice each other up, and the third picture shows an interaction between a B and a T helper. So the picture is almost exactly the same. Except, if this is a B cell, not only can it act as an antigen-presenting cell and activate a helper, but the helper can activate it. Now, once you get to the end of this, the B cell actually trapped some antigen, just like we said up there. The T helper came along and connected to it. Where did this piece come from? From the T cell or the B cell? This actually came from the B cell. And in the equivalent, it came from the macrophage. It came from the phagocytic cell. But how did this get here? And that's sort of the final piece of this that we want to explain. We said cells have on their surface little bits of whatever they're making. Now, if you look at your picture again, this diagram, you see that we have in the middle of the picture a cell this is a cell. It has some MHC, whichever kind, and then it has some epitopes. I made up two. How did they get there? If this is an infected cell, a cytotoxic T cell will come along, stick here, and zap it. If this is an immune system cell, a T helper cell will come along and stick to it and either activate it or be activated. But how did this stuff get there in the first place? Well, if you look on your picture on the left, you see that if you had a cell that was making protein inside on its ribosomes, we know that that's how the MHC is made. MHC is made on ribosomes attached to the ER, and it ends up in the endomembrane system. So both MHC1 and MHC2 are sort of standard surface proteins that get made on the ER, put into the ER, sent to the Golgi, et cetera, and end up on the surface. But how do they get their little piece of protein? Well, if you're making proteins inside a cell, spare proteins, little bits of protein, are always being cut up by proteasomes. Proteins wear out, and there's a little bit of turnover, and just about every protein you're making is occasionally cut up by a proteasome, and you have a piece collection. And there's a special transporter. Well, where are those pieces? Are they in the cytoplasm? Or are they in the ER? Where's the proteasome? It's in the cytoplasm, right? So those pieces would be in the cytoplasm. But there's a transporter that takes them into the ER. So the little pieces made by the proteasome go into the ER, where they meet MHC, and they end up on the surface. That was MHC1. But if you're a phagocytic cell or an antibody, where does your antigen come from? It's not stuff you made yourself. It's stuff you trapped or ate. An antigen, how did a B cell get antigen? The antigen bound to its B cell receptor, to its surface antibody. It endocytosed it. And if you endocytose something, where do you chew it up, usually? Lysosomes, and it ends up in lysosomes or endosomes or something like that. It ends up in the ER, I mean the endomembrane system. So if you take something in from the outside, whether you phagocytose it or whether you endocytose it, it ends up in the endomembrane system. That's where MHC2 is. So stuff that comes from the outside, and that's what the picture on your right is, that's either endocytosed or phagocytosed, ends up in the endomembrane system where it meets MHC2. So one way or the other, pieces of your internal protein end up on the outside, and pieces of your grabbed protein, if you're an immune system cell, end up on the outside. But which MHC they end up with depends on where they came from. Now, this picture on C summarizes all this activation who kicks who business. And one of the reasons for giving it to you is you should take it home and sort of figure out the pieces. It is deliberately not very well labeled. And in the final recitation problems, there will be a question which will ask you which piece is which will give you a clear idea of what you're supposed to figure out from looking at this picture. And you should look it up or ask if it's not obvious. Now, this leads us back to the question, which we actually discussed earlier. If each cell, either a T cell or a B cell, is making its own specific antibody, how on earth can you do it? How can you make so many antibodies or so many T cell receptors? And the answer to that really lies in the rearrangement of the DNA. And I want to say just a little bit about the structure of antibodies. We'll leave the structure of T cell receptors, but we've talked so much about antibodies that it makes sense to talk a little bit about their structure. And this is actually shown on handout B. On the very bottom right, you see a picture. We often draw antibodies like that, but we really know they have two grabbers, and it's probably more correct to draw them this way, because they have two identical halves. This is your classic antibody. This is the way we tend to draw it. But another representation of an antibody, which is more realistic, is shown next to it, like this. Every antibody actually has four peptide chains. And there are two relatively smaller ones and two relatively bigger ones. And they are known as L for light and H for heavy, referring to their molecular weight. So what makes up the grabber? If you look at it, this part of the light chain and this part of the heavy chain make up one grabber. So these together make up one grabber, and these together make up the other grabber. And the rest of it, so that's called the variable region, and that's the part that changes depending on which antigen it sticks to. That's what makes it specific. Now, the rest of it is called the constant part. During development, the DNA that rearranges is the part for the variable. You have a gene for the H chain. You have a section of DNA which rearranges and codes for an H chain. You have another section of the DNA that rearranges and codes for the L chain. Now, I should mention that MHC varies a lot too, but not because of DNA rearrangements. MHC is an ordinary gene. Everybody has two alleles of it. No funny business. But in the population as a whole, there are many, many different alleles of it. And so most people have a different MHC combination than other people. Before DNA tests, MHC testing was used for paternity tests. Now they use DNA instead. So as a result of rearrangements, each B cell is making a unique antibody. Now, what happens is after exposure to antigen, the descendants of that cell may make a different antibody. But the variable part isn't variable, it's the same. Once the variable is picked, all the descendants make antibodies that have the same variable. But the so-called constant may change. Remember, because of alternate splicing, we can make the hydrophobic tail version, or we can make the soluble tail version. As a result of either alternate processing or more DNA rearrangements, you can actually switch the back end part. Now, what difference does the back end make? The front end, or the variable, determines what antigen you'll stick to, and the back end determines what will happen afterwards. How will you destroy the antigen? Also, the back end or the constant end determines where the antibody will be found. Some antibodies are found in blood and tears, are found in tears and milk, exocrine secretions, and some are found only in blood. And there are five basic kinds of antibody, and they're listed in the table just for reference. And the difference between them is the so-called constant part, which determines the consequences. Not the antigen, but the consequences. Now, let me ask if there are questions about any of this. Yeah?
Your red blood cells don't have MHC1 because they don't have nucleus.
Your red blood cells do not have MHC1 because they have no nucleus. How do you fight something that infects your red blood cells? I'm not sure, but the answer to that in part is that red blood cells have a very short half-life, and so they don't last very long. But what is interesting, and he's brought it up, is that there are viruses which elude the immune system. Once they infect a cell, your immune system can't tell. How could your immune system not notice? One of the things they do sometimes is suppress the production of MHC1. If you don't make MHC1, there's nothing to stick the antigens to, and there's no samples of protein on the outside, and the immune system doesn't notice. Any other questions? Yeah.
For all the killing of the cells, we've been talking about membrane bound receptors, but the B cells, you said, to secrete them into the blood.
B cells secrete antibody into the blood. The attachment of antibodies, say, to a microbe, triggers other factors which destroy the cell. It's different from the way T cells destroy their target. T cells destroy eukaryotic cells one way. Soluble antibody destroys microbes a different way. Now, I want to wrap this up by saying something about next semester. I know that you have all registered already for what you're going to take. But you really can take a different 3,000-level bio course if you want to, because almost none of them have restricted registration. So if you're wondering which one to take, I would say whatever subject this year interests you most, that's the advanced course you ought to take, and not the one you think will look the best on your CV. You should balance both factors. But almost all of these classes require you to be there on the first day or you don't understand anything. So I strongly recommend that when the next semester rolls around, if you're not sure which class to go to, that you go to two or even to three. It makes for a hectic first week. But then when you decide which is the one you really like, you're not behind and you can forget about the others and you can drop and add more or less to your heart's content. It creates havoc with the registration, but we don't care. So I will see, I hope, some of you at least on Tuesday and the rest of you later.